You don't have to have this website and a link that people have to click on. You can just say stuff and you can get attention. You know, you don't need to be Breitbart to do that anymore.
Does the rise of X signal the fall of traditional right-wing outlets? From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Michael Loewinger. Also on this week's show, in Russia, a funeral, an election, and a journalist in prison.
But it's hard to see your friend and colleague on the front page of a magazine. I think he just wants to be writing the stories. I think he's wants to be in Russia reporting about this repression.
Plus, the importance of nuance to distinguish between terms like anti-colonial, decolonization.
There's a lot of these words kind of flying around, and there are many people who are not using them in a way that furthered the debate or even informed people.
It's all coming up after this.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Michael Loewinger.
My fellow Americans, the issue facing our nation isn't how old we are, it's how old are our ideas.
An energized Joe Biden speaking at the State of the Union on Thursday.
But you can't lead America with ancient ideas.
Joe Biden delivered what has been described in the press so far as feisty, fiery, heated.
You can tell how well he did by how annoyed Republicans are this morning.
A very different Joe Biden. I might call him Jacked Up Joe.
Sean Hannity of Fox News, who until now has preferred the Sleepy Joe epithet, a coinage from Donald Trump, or my predecessor, as Biden called him 13 times on Thursday. And so, now we've entered a new phase of the race. With Super Tuesday behind us and Nikki Haley out, Trump can finally start raising money like the GOP nominee. Just kidding, he's been at it for months.
Donald Trump's campaign is parlaying an embarrassing precedent into much-needed cash. The former president surrendered yesterday at an Atlanta jail. Here is the mugshot.
Trump's face is already making its way onto T-shirts and coffee mugs.
Donald Trump launching his own limited edition Trump digital trading cards.
His new Trump-branded sneakers. They are painted gold. They're named Never Surrender High Tops. I can't make this up, guys. And they sell for just under $400.
Despite all his merch sales and donations, Trump's campaign fundraising is lagging behind Team Biden. He's also on the hook for $83 million for defaming E. Jean Carroll and $355 million for fraudulent business practices in New York. Adding interest and other penalties, NPR estimated he owes $600 million. Enter the world's second richest man.
Check out this headline from the New York Times. Trump seeking cash infusion meets with Elon Musk.
Elon Musk is in a unique position to come close to erasing that deficit almost single-handedly.
But, writing in the Washington Post this week, columnist Philip Bump argued that, quote, it's not money that Elon Musk is contributing to Donald Trump. These two kindred spirits have other reasons for teaming up.
I think it's important to recognize that they are sort of reflections of each other, that Donald Trump was a business person who increasingly embraced right-wing politics and then moved into the political realm. Elon Musk was a business person and has increasingly embraced even further right-wing rhetoric and is becoming more of a political actor in part through his purchase of Twitter, which is now X. It is that similarity in both trajectory and landing point that made it sort of natural that the two of them would at some point in time put their heads together.
Musk tweeted that he was, quote, not donating money to either candidate for U.S. president. So Musk isn't going to give Trump money, right?
Well, there's a lot of wiggle room in not contributing to candidates, right? He could potentially donate to a super PAC. He could start his own super PAC, which is supporting Trump. He could do things like work out some sort of way of allowing Trump to advertise on his platform relatively inexpensively. There are lots of ways in which he can provide economic value to Trump.
So why would Elon Musk help Donald Trump financially?
Well, that's the central question. Elon Musk views himself as sort of sitting above the intellectual fray, that he understands the world in a way that others don't. He views himself in the world as sort of the prime mover, right? If you're Donald Trump and you're trying to get Elon Musk to give you money, probably the worst way to do it is to try and bring him on board Team Trump. Elon Musk doesn't want to be on anyone else's team. He wants to view Donald Trump as being on his team, make Donald Trump part of his collective. I do think that it's important to note that Elon Musk, by virtue of his ownership of X, really does sit on top of a conduit that is really important for Donald Trump, and not a financial one, but one that is centered on public attention.
If I were Donald Trump and I were following what has very clearly happened to X since Elon Musk took over, I would say to myself, seems like this guy's already pretty aligned with me. I mean, just look at his tweets.
Elon Musk purchased Twitter, now X, in part as a reaction to this right-wing idea that moderation on Twitter had become something that was an impediment to conservatives. Now, that moderation that Twitter and others like Facebook had implemented was a response to an increase in abusive and toxic behavior and misinformation that emerged during 2016, in part because of Donald Trump supporters. And that was viewed by the political right as being an imposition on conservative ideology. Musk reacts to that, buys Twitter/X, and then lifts that moderation. So Elon Musk, by purchasing the social media platform, has reverted it to the sort of platform that it was in 2016 when it was so advantageous to Donald Trump.
And not only has he reverted it, but the guy who owns the platform, who is the most followed person on the platform with over 175 million followers, is himself spreading right-wing conspiracy theories, this week in particular, about immigration.
So this week, he has embraced this idea that Democrats are trying to bring immigrants into the country so that then they can vote. And we've seen him do this in the past, using, for example, when he elevated this Associated Press story that Biden wanted to create a pathway to citizenship for people who are in the country and who are not yet citizens.
This is an article from 2021.
That's exactly right. Before he was even president. And the article basically said, Joe Biden, as soon as he becomes president, is going to introduce this proposed bill. And so he did. He introduced a proposed bill for a pathway to citizenship, and it went into the House, and nothing happened. But that's what Musk is using to say, oh, look what Biden's trying to do because they're trying to get all these Democratic voters. And it's just fundamentally dishonest. And one wonders whether or not Elon Musk recognizes it as dishonest. But either way, it's advantageous to Donald Trump's position on the way immigration should be addressed.
On Tuesday, he posted that Biden had committed treason. The so-called Treasonous Act was a new program which would allow Cubans, Haitians, Nicaraguans, and Venezuelans, if they had a sponsor in the U.S. and they passed a background check, to work lawfully in the United States for 2 years, hardly sneaking people in.
Yeah, exactly. Treason has a very specific definition, which is that you have to aid an enemy of the United States that the United States is at war with. It makes no sense. It's obviously just rhetorical, and it's obviously Elon Musk's sort of knee-jerk reaction to having immigration increase in the United States. Now, there's an irony here, of course, which is that Elon Musk is himself an immigrant to the United States, who has celebrated the fact that he did so by following the standard procedure. But this is exactly that sort of policy, right? This is something that was authorized to have people come to the United States as immigrants and be able to be successful here for a period of time. This gets turned around by Elon Musk into something that is evidence of Joe Biden's secret plan to subvert the United States.
And this brand of conspiracy theory is like super hot right now in the right-wing media. According to Media Matters, in just the last couple months, we've heard it on Fox.
The Democrat Party, the U.S. government gets what they want, which is a new wave of immigrants, perhaps future voters.
On One American News Network.
If illegal aliens turn residents, turn citizens, turn voters, would vote Republican, you and I would not be having this conversation. Yeah. That is their agenda. They're trying to change the electorate because they cannot win without importing more Democrat voters. That's a whole ballgame.
On Newsmax.
How many of you feel better that to start with, Democrats are pushing to let foreign nationals cancel out your vote, but only on local elections?
And on right-wing radio.
This is revolution by illegal immigration, Mr. Producer.
It sounds a lot like the Great Replacement Theory.
Exactly. I mean, the Great Replacement Theory puts forward that there is this cabal that is trying to bring new people to the United States to replace those that are here. I mean, it just, on the face of it, doesn't really make any sense. Over the course of the past decade or so, we have seen that there is not necessarily a consistent pattern in voting. for Hispanics who live in the United States. It is not the case that even if you were to have a number of immigrants and create a pathway for them to become citizens to the vote, those aren't Democratic voters. That's just simply not how it works. This is not a function of the Biden administration. The path to becoming a citizen takes years and years and years. There's no blanket thing that Joe Biden can do to turn these people into voters. And even if he were to do so, the odds that they vote Democratic are not as high as being presented.
After Fox's $787 million settlement with Dominion and the ongoing Smartmatic defamation case, you'd think that right-wing media would be way more careful about these kind of voter fraud claims this time around. And yet, these conspiracy theories sure sound like fodder for claims to delegitimize a possible Biden win in November.
Yeah, I think that's true. But I also think that more broadly, this fits into the way in which the political right have tried to delegitimize Democratic voting in general. Doing things like insisting that the reason young voters like Democrats isn't because they're particularly concerned about climate change or gun control or things along those lines. It's because they're being brainwashed by their high school teachers and their professors. It assumes that if you are someone who supports the Democratic Party, you are necessarily being misled in some way, convinced by Hollywood or by ads or by CNN or MSNBC to vote in a particular way that if you were simply a rational person, you wouldn't. And so they have to cheat. They have to try and bring in these non-white, always as being the subtext here, people to come into the United States and turn them into Democrats. Because, of course, once again, they're just going to vote Democratic because Democrats are all sheep. And this is just a way of increasing the size of the flock.
In 2020, the right-wing media were obsessed with the vote-by-mail conspiracy theory, that people who wanted to vote from home would be taking advantage of a system to nefariously vote extra times or what have you. And this year, it's the undocumented immigrants conspiracy theory that has emerged thus far. There's still plenty of time for other fear-mongering messages and conspiracy theories to rival this one. But could you compare and contrast how this election feels compared to 2020?
Back in 2020, we heard a lot of similar conspiracy theories about what was going on with crime, right? That the social justice protests that unfolded over the summer, some of which culminated in acts of vandalism and destruction, you know, most of them didn't, as we all know by now, that was spun as being this horrible thing that presaged what was going to happen under President Biden. Fox News, night after night after night, would show the same footage of acts of vandalism in New York City. You still hear today Republicans talking about how cities were burned to the ground and destroyed in 2020 and, you know, just simply detached from reality. But I think that's the role that immigration is going to play this time. The migrant crime wave, this is already something that Donald Trump and Fox News have picked up, this idea of migrant crime as being something that needs to be tracked independently.
We started the conversation talking about Elon Musk and his growing coalition with MAGA activists, the MAGA leader Donald Trump himself, and the movement at writ large. This transformation of X/Twitter comes at a time when, interestingly, right-wing media seem to be really struggling. New data released last month from The Writing, using traffic data from Comscore, showed that for the top right-wing sites, only Newsmax has gained traffic since 2020, and just about everyone else has lost a lot of traffic. Fox is down 24%. The Blaze is down 60%. Breitbart is down 87%. This is worse than the dips in traffic we're seeing for mainstream outlets like CNN, 20% dip. New York Times, 22% dip during the same four-year period. Are conservatives spending less time reading about politics? Or do you think, as David French argued this week in the New York Times, conservative right-wing readers are increasingly spending their time on Elon Musk's X or other right-wing social media?
I think it's probably more of the latter. One of the things that we saw over the course of the past 15 years or so is you had Fox News as behemoth on the right, and it started to be challenged from the right by sites like Breitbart and eventually sites like the conspiracy site Gateway Pundit. You had these people who were willing to feed the demand of further right content. Donald Trump was successful in 2015, 2016, I would argue, because he echoed the themes that were emerging from that further right world of conservative media and conservative thought. He would frequently cite articles from Breitbart and so on and so forth. But what happened is that social media made it so that you could move very easily even further right. You didn't have to put together a website. You didn't have to put together a news article with an ostensible reporter reporting it out. You could just say stuff, right? And he could get attention. One of the better known people in the conservative social media world is this guy who calls himself Cat Turd. He sat down for an interview with Tucker Carlson. And in an interview, revealed that he didn't really know that much about politics, but he just has this ability to sort of respond in real time to what's happening and frame things in a way that is viewed appreciatively by the right. And it's made him very successful. You don't need to be Breitbart to do that anymore. And you can gain clout. And even because of the way that Musk has set up the platform now, you can get money from it. That is an unusual driver of the decline that we're seeing among conservative media outlets. It is extremely bad to have one of the principal drivers of the national conversation be a guy named Cat Turd who gets retweeted by the president.
Philip, thank you very much.
You bet.
Philip Bump is a columnist for The Washington Post and the author of the weekly newsletter, How to Read This Chart.
Coming up, before we argue about the conflict in Palestine, we have to talk about colonization and colonialism and know the difference.
This is On the Media.
This is Brooke. When you finish listening to OTM this week, why don't you head over to the New Yorker Radio Hour? My colleague David Remnick sat down with Jerry Seinfeld, who just directed his first movie.
This is the only idea I've ever had for a film.
Really?
I never get asked to do a film.
Really?
Never.
You know, you really should listen to the New Yorker Radio Hour.
So please, do what Brooke says. Come join us for the New Yorker Radio Hour wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Michael Loanger.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Here's President Biden on Thursday night.
For the leadership of Israel, I say this. Humanitarian assistance cannot be a secondary consideration or a bargaining chip. Protecting and saving innocent lives has to be a priority. As we look to the future, the only real solution to the situation is a two-state solution over time.
Since October 7th, many have been grasping for ways to explain or even describe an intractable crisis in Palestine spanning generations. And to that end, three words are being deployed over and over again: colonialism, decolonization, and liberation.
We were pushing for a free, independent Palestine. We're pushing for decolonization, land back, etc.
Decolonization, free Palestine, that equals the slaughter of Jews.
I felt that there's a lot of these words kind of flying around, and there are many people who are not using them in a way that furthered the debate or even informed people.
Iyad el-Baghdadi's forebears left what is now Tel Aviv in 1948. Today, he's a Palestinian human rights activist, a writer, and co-author of The Middle East Crisis Factory. In November, he wrote a thread on Twitter, X, clarifying what terms like colonialism and decolonization really mean and why muddling them can be risky.
To colonize means we just establish a colony. If we go to Mars, for example, and we establish a base over there, we can say it's a Mars colony. Colonialism, on the other hand, to colonialize, is really an exercise in hegemony. It's a mode of domination. This is where a society might have existed for its own sake, but through the deployment of immense power, immense hegemony, you can turn it into something that doesn't exist for its own sake.
Colonialism, he says, comes in two flavors. First, the extractive kind.
In extractive colonialism, the objective is to extract wealth away. You need a labor class, you need people to work the fields, you need people to work the plantations. You need them subjugated, but you don't need them dead.
And then the second, settler colonialism, where the colonizer wants the land without the people. And that, el-Baghdadi says, describes what happened in Palestine.
In settler colonialism, the colonizer here wants the land for expansion, for a new settlement displacing the natives. The tools of hegemony over here are much more brutal because we don't need those people to be there.
But the word that's most muddled, and he says dangerously so, is decolonization. It's too often confused with another term, anti-colonial.
Not every anti-colonial movement is decolonial. Anti-colonial simply mean opposed to the presence of colonialism. Anti-colonial movements themselves can fall into the same patterns of the colonizers. They can start to have a worldview which is built upon these colonial concepts. Decolonization, on the other hand, the way that I approach it is that it's not really about removing people. It's about removing supremacy. There's no longer colonizer and colonized. They're simply equal citizens in one state. This, of course, does not erase the inequities of the past, but this is the only light that can lead us towards the future.
So you argue that there are two main models of settler colonialism, and understanding the nuances of these models is key to reckoning with Palestine. There's the Algeria model and the South African model. They've both been applied to Palestine.
Algeria was colonized by the French for a period of around 132 years. The model followed by the Algeria independence movement was mainly a military approach, make the colony unlivable until they leave. Algeria managed to accomplish that eventually in, I believe, 1962. In the South Africa model, the colonial situation was resolved by creating a democracy that included both the previously colonized and the previous colonizer in a democracy. One person, one vote. Everybody has the same citizenship, the same rights. Whether you pick the Algeria model or the South Africa model, the kind of movement that you build is going to be very different. 21 years ago, in a 2003 interview, Ehud Olmert, who at the time was Sharon's deputy prime minister, actually referenced the Algeria model and the South Africa model in reference to Israeli plans to withdraw unilaterally from Gaza. This is literally what he said. More and more Palestinians are uninterested in a negotiated two-state solution because they want to change the essence of the conflict from an Algerian paradigm to a South African one. From a struggle against occupation in their parlance to a struggle for one man, one vote. That is, of course, a much cleaner struggle, a much more popular struggle, and ultimately a much more powerful one. For us, it would mean the end of the Jewish state.
He's saying basically that there cannot be a two-state solution.
Because it was perceived that Palestinian statehood would be a lethal threat to the Jewishness of the state. This was where the current impasse, where we have a status quo where it's neither Algeria nor South Africa, but kind of both, the pre-October 7th kind of reality, was not something that Israel stumbled into, but an accomplishment of two generations of Israeli politicians. It was a conscious choice. October 2004, senior advisor to Ariel Sharon, it says the significance of the disengagement plan, which is pulling out from Gaza, is to freeze the peace process. And when you freeze that process, you prevent the establishment of a Palestinian state. And you prevent a discussion on the refugees, the borders, and Jerusalem. Effectively, this whole package called a Palestinian state, with all that it entails, has been removed indefinitely from our agenda.
What would be the result of pursuing the Algeria model in Palestine? Because a big part of the Palestinian movement doesn't acknowledge Israel's right to exist.
They don't. Algerians were fighting around the same time that Palestinians were fighting, but Algerians won. Many Palestinians got this impression that, yes, we have to do the same thing that they did. My position, of course, and the position of many others, is that French Algeria is not Israel. There are many, many reasons.
For one thing, the French had a place to go.
Yep.
They could go back to France.
Yeah. Meanwhile, Israelis have nowhere to go. Also, at the height of French colonialism in Algeria, I don't think the French non-natives exceeded 20% of the population. They were always a minority. In the case of Israel slash Palestine, it's, you know, half and half. Israel was founded by Holocaust survivors. They were escaping a millennium of European anti-Semitism. This changes the psychological dynamic. These are two peoples locked into a cycle of trauma, traumatizing each other, but also traumatized. We can't lose our humanity when we actually approach this conflict.
As far as the pro-Palestinian movement that still thinks about Algeria, just make Israel unlivable and they'll all leave, you say it's a dead end.
I'm saying that it's not desirable. The objective is not simply to defeat Israel. It's not simply to liberate Palestine. It is also to give us a country that we can live in. A country that is liberated into a pile of rubble, into a whirlpool of pain, into pools of blood, that is not a livable country. The mistaken idea that in the conception of many Palestinians, but also pro-Palestinians, this is still the Israel of 1948. This is still an Israel which is basically mostly European, white settlers, Jewish people coming basically from Europe. This is not the case now. This is not today's Israel. More than 60% of Israelis today have at least full or partial Middle Eastern heritage, you know, basically descended from Middle Eastern Jews. The whole idea that this is still a white settler colony is not true anymore.
You wrote that decolonization doesn't mean removing people. It means removing domination. And that's why South Africa is a helpful model.
Because it is rooted in values such as equality, coexistence, humanity, integration. On the other hand, there is a demographic reality here. It's true that even in South Africa, the white population were always a minority. The fact that we are talking about a demographic reality where we have roughly 50% Palestinians, 50% Jewish people, the premise of equality here is far more applicable. We have to think in intergenerational terms, because really, I see a lot of Palestinians, but also Israelis now, asking the questions like, how can we live with these people after what they have done? There's two ways that I respond to this. The first is, tough luck, you're going to live with these people. And the question is, how? There are babies who are going to be born tomorrow between the river and the sea, some Jewish, some Palestinian. We have to ask ourselves, what do we want for them 20 years or 30 years from now? Do we still want them to be doing what we're doing right now? We would have failed them. We would have failed our own children.
Many people discuss Palestinian liberation as a clean reversal of 1948, the Nakba. Edward Said, the late prominent Palestinian-American scholar, warned that obsession with the past will doom a movement.
Yep. I think this difficulty of imagining the future is itself an impact of trauma. The Nakba being kind of an ongoing trauma, it started but it never ended. When you don't mourn the past, it remains in your present and it blocks your vision of the future. Time only goes forward. We cannot undo the past. We have to be informed by the past, inspired by the past. And maybe sometimes the past is a cautionary tale. But in the end, time only moves forward and liberation itself has to only move forward.
You have observed that people who have been systematically excluded end up as nihilists or architects. You are a stateless refugee until last summer.
Yep. Me being a stateless refugee my entire life has given me this innate, almost automatic radicalism. I'm 46 years old. I was a stateless refugee until last summer. My family left Jaffa in 1948. It was my grandfather, and my father, who was a toddler at the time.
Jaffa, which is now Tel Aviv.
Exactly. This was four generations of statelessness. And what that does to you is that you know that there is nothing worth preserving for you in the current world order. But then there's a very important distinction here in how we speak about this. We can either say it cannot be reformed, it must be destroyed. Or we can say it cannot be reformed, we have to build a replacement. The first, I would say, is nihilistic. Well, I just want to destroy it. Changing the world, this kind of decolonial vision, is a task for entrepreneurs, for architects, not for nihilists. We have to have the imagination to build that kind of mass movement premised upon equality, premised upon solidarity, and premised upon humanity. People are starting to think that there is no future in which a Jewish person and a Palestinian person can live together in peace in one country. But this is exactly why we have to double down on it. I don't think I'm the one who's dysfunctional for thinking that democracy and humanity is the only thing that can win. I really think that anybody who thinks that anything else can fix this is the one who's dysfunctional.
So what do you think a viable movement for Palestinian liberation would look like?
Look, this is not only going to be about liberating Palestinians. Ultimately, this is also about liberating Jewish Israelis. It's really about humanizing both the colonizer and the colonized. Maybe I'm not the right person to speak about this, but when I speak to my Jewish Israeli friends, they say that they are not free because they're living in this entity which is always scared. If you have to kill that many people in order to feel safe, that means you're never going to feel safe. Colonialism is not only brutal to the colonized, but also to the soul of the colonizer. And this decolonial movement should be led by the colonized. But this movement has to center both peoples, building a future for both peoples. This is not going to be something that we're going to fix in 10 years or 15 years. I'm thinking 20 years and above. You asked me a question like, is the Algeria model possible or not? I mean, even if we acknowledge that it's possible, is going to require rivers of blood, a lot of destruction. As a Palestinian, I want a country that my children and grandchildren can live in with full dignity, with freedom, not a country without Jews.
If you listen to the rhetoric of some of the members of the current Israeli government and the leadership of Hamas, there are a lot of similarities. Neither of them would really cotton to the South Africa model.
Yeah, this is true. There is a paradigm of partition and segregation and domination that's kind of premised upon this idea of ethnic nationalism. There's another paradigm here. I don't want to talk about the one-state solution, but the paradigm here. The paradigm is an integration paradigm. It's about equality, it's about integration, it's about coexistence. My premise is that this paradigm is the only thing that can move forward. The path in front of us from here, from post-October 7th, is a state of sustained crisis, an actual zero sum, where anything the Israelis get, they're going to get by taking it away from Palestinians or taking away Palestinians. And anything that Palestinians can get, they're going to have to get it by taking it away from Israelis. This strategic nihilism is only a reflection of something much deeper, which is the cycle of trauma that we're locked into. Current politicians, current movements, etc., who are locked into this old way of thinking, all they're going to give us is more of the same. More bloodshed, more conflict, more violence, more war. Palestinians, their backs are to the wall, they're being starved, they're being bombed. They feel like the only thing they can do is fight back. We live in a two-state solution world. We live in a world in which we have, for 75 years, we decided that the solution over here is partition and domination. We have two paths. One path is completely blocked. The other path is intergenerational and is very steep and is going to take a lot of work, but at least it can get us there. Mm. The history of the Jewish people is very long, very well-documented history and a very proud history. The state of Israel, this phase of history, which is marked by ethno-nationalism, is only one chapter. I want Jewish people to thrive in the Middle East, in their native region, for a very long time. Maybe the prerequisite for that is to give up on this idea of ethno-nationalism and to embrace each other as brothers and sisters without questions of who belongs and who doesn't belong.
Up until this summer, you were stateless.
Yep.
What happened?
Well, I was granted Norwegian citizenship last summer. I remember that moment of time when I had to actually go to a government office to give up my refugee travel document. I mean, I don't think a little tiny booklet has ever felt this heavy in my hand. It felt to me that I'm not gaining a new identity or a new citizenship, but giving up an identity. It almost felt like a betrayal of my ancestors who never made it, and many Palestinians who never made it. I remember waking up the next morning, summer in Norway is beautiful, and I live very central in Oslo, and walked up to the terrace in my apartment, looked out in all directions, and I got this sense of immense love, a physical feeling of love all over my body, and I was able to say to myself for the first time, this is my country, and these are my people, and together, from this place of safety and prosperity and privilege, we're going to do everything that we can to heal our world.
Iyad, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Iyad El-Baghdadi is a human rights activist, writer, and author of the book, The Middle East Crisis Factory, Tyranny, Resilience, and Resistance.
Coming up, after 2 years of war in Ukraine, a close-up view of 20 excruciating days in Mariupol.
This is On the Media.
This is On the Media. I'm Michael Loewinger.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. It's just over 2 years since Russia launched a full-scale invasion of Ukraine, and there's no end yet in sight.
Ukrainian troops film themselves as they withdraw from Avdiivka. Exhausted after the longest and perhaps the bloodiest battle of the war so far.
Zelensky said his soldiers had been outgunned 10 to 1 and made an urgent appeal for more weapons from the international community.
Next week in Russia, polls will be open for a full 3 days, enabling citizens lots of time to vote in Russian President Vladimir Putin for a fifth six-year term. All of Putin's potential challengers have been eliminated by legal means or extra-legal ones, like Putin's best-known nemesis, Alexei Navalny, who died under extreme duress in an Arctic penal colony on February 16th. His body was laid in the ground on March 1st, and 2 weeks later, Russians are still paying their respects.
People have been streaming into the graveyard every day while it's open and lining up and waiting to lay flowers.
Valerie Hopkins is an international correspondent at the New York Times covering Russia. She says that the mound of flowers on Navalny's grave has grown so large that you can barely make out the wooden cross atop it.
Some of the places across Russia where people went to lay flowers, they were asked to show their passports, and some people were arrested on the spot. Others had law enforcement bodies coming to their homes later. And I think it's quite a testament to how beloved Alexei Navalny was that people are trekking out to a southern suburb to really show their support for someone that the Russian authorities consider to be a terrorist and extremist, and still people are coming.
More than 400 people have been detained across Russia for publicly paying tribute to Navalny.
In the same week, one of Russia's best-known human rights activists, Olya Gorlov, was sentenced to 2.5 years in jail because of his opposition to the war. This is someone who was part of a group of people who won the 2022 Nobel Peace Prize. He's 70. He was sentenced for the crime of what's called, quote, repeatedly discrediting the Russian armed forces.
And March 29th, will mark 1 year since Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovich was arrested while doing his job in Russia.
Evan is on the cover of this week's Time magazine, and I'm so grateful. But I think he just wants to be in Russia reporting about this repression.
Hopkins says that Russians fear a new mobilization after the election as Russia's Ukrainian quagmire drags painfully on. But as war fatigue and other global conflicts push Ukraine's front line further and further from the media spotlight, a film that palpably conveys the invasion's brutality is up for an Oscar. In February of 2022, Mstislav Chernov, a video journalist for the Associated Press, went to Mariupol, the critical port city on Ukraine's southeastern edge, just 35 miles from the Russian border. He arrived an hour before the first bombs hit the city. What Chernov chronicled over the next 3 weeks is captured in the documentary 20 Days in Mariupol. He was there as a reporter. Only a fraction of his footage actually made it to the outside world. But when it did, it hit hard.
AP reporters on the ground showed the world a mass grave in Mariupol.
I'm talking about narrow trenches in Mariupol with babies' bodies in. AP journalists have been there.
I've seen so many fakes. Who wins the information war? The one wins the war.
Do you really truly believe this? Do you truly believe what you're saying?
At every moment, we get to see what he sees, and a warning, that's pretty disturbing.
We immediately started hearing explosions on the outskirts. There were flashes of light you could see from the window. It was still dark. The battle was largely happening on the outskirts of the city, military bases and the trenches that were built there for years. For a while, it was calm. There was no panic. Some people went to work. And it was quite surreal because I had a feeling that something horrible is coming, judging by just how Russia deals with cities that it tries to attack, how it was with Grozny, how it was with Aleppo.
Early in the film, you meet a panicked woman crying, "Where shall I go? What shall I do?" And to calm her down, you tell her to go into her basement. They won't shell civilian areas. And of course, they do. And later, you see her at a shelter, and she reminds you of your not-so-great advice. And you say, "I'm sorry."
I feel like I am telling the story of the community that I'm part of. And sometimes it is kind of hard for me to decide what's best to keep filming or just to try to help. That's kind of like a core thought which I wanted to come through my narration, that I am not a distant narrator. At the same time, I didn't want to impose my emotions on the audience.
But in describing their trauma, you're also describing your own. It's evident in your simple words of description, but behind it, so much weariness.
That is something that probably all Ukrainian journalists feel, and probably all conflict journalists feel.
one of the most horrendous moments includes the aftermath of a maternity hospital bombing. Incredibly hard to watch. One very pregnant, very injured woman is carried out on a stretcher. We don't know her fate. But then at a second hospital, you find the doctor who treated her. She said that her pelvis had been shattered by the explosion and that the mother and baby died.
Her name was Irina. They said she screamed, "Kill me," when they brought her. She knew her child was dead.
We see nurses getting sniped out, so many dead babies. The kind of thing that a news consumer in America would never see on television. What do you think about American mores when it comes to war violence?
It is crucially important for the war coverage not to be sanitized in any way, because if people see only, let's say, light version of the events, they tend to accept war, and it's just unacceptable. So we didn't sanitize anything when we were editing. I remember when Russia shut down MH17 airplane over Donbass 9 years ago.
The Malaysian airliner.
Yeah, the Malaysian airlines. I was one of the first journalists at the scene. Filmed with hundreds of bodies scattered across the fields and melted plastic with human bones. And it was horrifying. Most of those images never made it to screens because it was really too difficult. But I think if we would be filming this now, we could show much more the limits to what international outlets are showing to their viewers have changed. There's just too many war crimes. It's just impossible to ignore it.
And you're not worried about numbness or empathy fatigue in viewers?
It's important to find balance. You cannot just bombard audience with blood and tears and expect people to care all the time. It needs context to show how people react and how they feel.
Speaking of reaction, there were a few moments in the film where you hear people expressing disdain for you and the crew being there. And then we saw a lot of people feeling quite the opposite.
For most of the people, it was a chance to even just send message to their relatives. People would just come up to us on the street and ask to film them. And then they would just ask us, is Ukraine still exists as a country? How is Kyiv doing? How is Kharkiv, Odessa? Is Ukraine army resisting? And other people came and said, please keep filming. And I think this is also gives us a good understanding of how not just a physical military siege works on psychology of people. It's also an information siege that destroys the society.
Which brings to mind that when Global TV used some of your footage, Russian officials specifically labeled the footage you were able to get out from, say, the bombing at the maternity ward or the mass graves as propaganda.
Yeah, they said we are information terrorists and that we staged everything. I think it's a part of the story, because the story is not only what happens on the ground, it's the ripples of the information that is going across the planet, influencing people.
There's a moment in the film that might have not worked at all, because you leave the present moment and you offer a montage of the terrible trials of the Ukrainian people in recent history.
I think about all this country has been through over the past 8 years. All that I filmed, Revolution of Dignity, Crimea's annexation, Russia's invasion of Donbass.
The acrid smell of violence.
MH17.
Seems to waft off the screen.
Donetsk airport siege. War that seems endless. We keep filming. And things stay the same. Worse even. Propaganda turns everything upside down.
That interlude offered some really essential context.
It is coming after very hard moments, heartbreaking moments. And I felt like we all needed time to reflect and prepare for what's coming next.
You've mentioned elsewhere that the footage was not taken to be a film. It was simply news dispatches.
But further the siege went, more we realized that we were the only ones who were sending anything from the city, any information, any footage. More I knew that I need to capture every minute. There are so many stories I was just told about, or I got firsthand but was not able to film because I was hiding, I was afraid, and that is a regret too. Probably I just need to write those stories. I guess that's the only way to tell them.
You need to tell them all?
They're so important somehow to be told. There's a story of a woman who is sitting in a corridor after we witness the birth of a child in a hospital and before we find out that we are surrounded.
They aren't sure whether the child is alive and they keep smacking it and rubbing it. And then suddenly this triumphant...
And the doctors told me that the birth is just like a ray of light from heaven for them. So we walk back to the entrance of the hospital and I meet a woman who tells the story of her children that were killed by a shell in their basement. And I have a footage of those children. It's not in a film. We thought it would be just too much. But later on, we found her and we know that they buried their children in the yard of their house. And then they left the city through the green corridor and they came back to rebury the children. And they didn't find them in the place where they were supposed to be. And they went through these hundreds of bodies that were just piled up near the hospital to try to find the bodies of their children. And they did, just before they were dropped in the mass grave, like to be lost forever. And they gave them a proper burial.
I'm wondering about the policeman who helped you for a while, Vladimir, who asked to make a statement in front of the camera.
Russian troops commit war crimes. Our family, our women, our children need help. Our people need help from international society. Please help Mariupol.
I think every war reporter, maybe every reporter, faces this question eventually, and they have to find an answer. Do you really believe you can make a difference?
You know, I faced that question exactly in 2014 while filming the MH17. And I thought the war is going to stop when the world sees this footage. And it, of course, didn't. I just got worse. So I don't have a lot of illusions about direct power of journalism. We are not soldiers. We can't change the course of events. All we can do is just keep telling everyone about them. But there is something that was done. Some families found their loved ones because they saw them in the photos and in the videos, and they were able to locate them in the city and extract them and save their lives. Authorities have used what we filmed to negotiate the Green Corridor, which also saved lives. So this is like immediate, direct effect that we can do. Whether we have an impact in the long term, I don't know. I guess we will see much later when we look back. But again, even if it just remains in history, even if the film remains as an evidence of what happened in the first days of full-scale invasion, that's already a lot. Because we judge the world around us by watching news and reading headlines and through our screens. We understand our past through cinema, through documentary films, feature films, books. That's where these films are important for generations that are to come.
What do you want viewers to take away from this?
I definitely want viewers to take away hope. And they do.
Viewers take away hope from this film?
Despite so much desperation, hope is coming through because people see how Ukrainians resist, how they survive, that desperation does not give us strength to keep going. Hope does.
What do you think is the most hopeful moment in your film?
The birth of a child, yeah. After what we've seen, after all the children that have died, knowing that this is just a tiny fraction of what happened, seeing that a child was born and it's healthy and now we know his child survived, that is the most crucial moment for me in the film and the most hopeful one.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Mstislav Chernov is a journalist and director of the 2023 documentary 20 Days in Mariupol. He's also a novelist. His latest is called The Dreamtime.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Eloise Blondio, Molly Rosen, Rebecca Clark-Callender, and Candace Wong, with help from Sean Merchant.
Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Andrew Nerviano and Brendan Dalton. Katya Rogers is our executive producer. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Michael Loewinger.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.